This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ted Genoways is the executive editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review, one of the nation's best magazines, a national journal of literature and discussion produced right here at the University of Virginia, if I'm not mistaken, still produced right there on West Range, right across from Alderman Library.
That's right.
Good afternoon, Ted.
Thanks for having me, Coy.
We're here to talk about the spring issue, which recently hit the bookstores. And before we go any further, where can folks find this? Where do you find the Virginia Quarterly Review if you want to go out and buy it and read it, which everyone should?
Yes, they certainly should. And you can find it at any of the local bookstores. The thing is well distributed, especially here locally. And you can also... you can drop by our offices, as you said, at One West Range, or you can order it off the website. If you want to find the magazine, you really have no excuse. You can find it.
And, of course, the website is vqronline.org.
That's right.
There's a whole lot of stuff on there that you find in addition to the magazine. There's podcasts and a lot of even extra text. And
exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So the spring issue on the very front is Drawing the Line. And you have Phil Caputo in here, Mark Ehrman, really amazing work yet again. And just to remind folks, last year at the National Magazine Awards, the VQR won the top magazine of the country up against National Geographic and Time and Newsweek.
Yeah, we were nominated in our circulation range and won last year. We were nominated again this year and just last week managed to lose out to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
Oh, dog. I'm sorry about that.
It's all right. It was a good year to be an atomic scientist. They had lots of good stuff this year, and it was good company.
Ted Genoways of the Virginia Quarterly Review. If at any time in this conversation you'd like to join in, it's 977-1070. Ted, tell us about the picture on the front of this issue. What am I looking at?
Well, it's part of the existing border wall between the U.S. and Mexico, and it's part of that whole system, really, of walls that's been proposed to try to close off the southern U.S. border against illegal immigration from Mexico.
It really is. The first thing that hits you out there is, number one, what a crappy little wall this is.
Yeah.
You can literally walk around it.
Yeah. Right now there are plenty of places where you can just simply walk around the wall. And as, it's actually Mark Ehrman who points out that at one point in his essay, when he's, looking at one of the sections of the wall that in order to save money, the wall was set up, so that the corrugated sheets ran, lengthwise rather than being mounted vertically. And what that did is create essentially a ladder that's built right into the wall itself. And there are lots of great pictures of people just using that corrugation to climb right up and over the wall.
My goodness.
So, I mean, and that's really at the heart of Mark's essay, where he's gone and looked at different border walls and in particular looked at the Berlin Wall and looked at the border fence between Israel and the Palestinian territories. And the questions that he's asking are, first of all, you know, logistically, what has to be done for a wall to work, to keep people in or to keep people out? And then there's the larger philosophical question, once you establish that, is this something that we really want to do? When you start looking at what the impact is on the national psyche, and not just, you know, I think a lot of people focus on what the impact is on the Mexican national psyche, but I mean, in this case, what does this do to our sense of who we are as Americans? And I think that's a really central question. If you're going to build a wall that size and that length to actually keep people out, you're going to have to commit a lot of resources, and it's going to become a major part of who we are as a country.
Because you don't just build it, you got to maintain it, because Absolutely. Every night somebody's going to go out and try to tear off part of it.
That's right. Yeah. And the number of patrol officers and just all of the resources that have to be contributed to it. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is really what Phil Caputo is reporting on in his lead piece. And I think it's just a remarkable piece of journalism that Caputo's done for us. And the thing that I love about the piece is that it completely challenged all of the notions that I had about what needed to be done on the border. And I think it'll do that for anyone, no matter who they are as readers, that there is something there to complicate anybody's view of the border. Now, the downside of that is that he doesn't come up with any sort of simple, coherent solution. What he's
there done, isn't any.
No.
There aren't any, are there?
Exactly. I mean, and I think it can be kind of a confounding piece because you get to the end of it, and I think the only conclusion that you can reach is, boy, this is going to be a really tough situation no matter what we do, and there's going to be downsides to any decision that we make here. But I think he at the same time does a great job of humanizing everyone who is involved in this process. That for me, the thing that was most important about the piece was seeing his interviews with some of the people, the Minutemen along the border, and portraying them less as you know, crazed zealots, and more as concerned citizens who had legitimate worries about what was going on in the border, and less as vigilantes than as people who saw themselves as in a really difficult situation that they were trying to help the Border Patrol. And I think that in some ways this is it's the Minuteman propaganda that's been the problem, the thing that's worked against them themselves, is that they've tried to present themselves as being this sort of paramilitary group when, as Caputo shows, in fact, they're mostly retirees in lawn chairs with binoculars and cell phones. And that's not the image they want to convey. But for me, that made them much more human and much more understandable.
Yeah. When you go down there and actually sit with them, as Phil did, you it's a totally different image than you might see from one person interviewed on CNN or Fox.
Right. Right.
You really see a group of people who really want to try to do something good.
Right. Yeah. And everyone is in the same stew together. I mean, that by focusing equally on the ranchers on the U.S. side and on the immigrants coming from the Mexican side, I think he does a great job of showing that the people on the U.S. side aren't simply racist and xenophobic and so on, but they have legitimate concerns that have to do with the fact that a large portion of the traffic coming across are drug traffickers, that they are increasingly armed and are increasingly aware that the Border Patrol is out and looking for them and are more dangerous now than ever. And everything has gotten so tense along the border that those people who live there, regardless of which side they're on, are in a really dangerous situation.
Philip Caputo's new article is Life on the Line, the Arizona-Mexico Border. It's in the spring edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review, and we are honored to have in studio the editor-in-chief at the VQR, Ted Genoways. There's other articles in this issue, like you point out, that explore this very idea of a border or a fence along a border.
Right. Yeah. We, generally speaking, when we put together a group of essays, especially on a complex issue like this, we try to bring in lots of different voices with different opinions. And there's the essay by Charles Rapley that makes a case for opening the borders, which for the record is not something that I support, but I think he makes a really compelling case. And then, as I said, Mark Ehrman's piece, where he goes and tries to look at border walls historically. But I also think that there's something really valuable presented. Reynaldo Leal has a great series of photographs that he had taken along the Texas-Mexico border. There are poems by Alberto Rios and Luis Alberto Urrea. There's a great selection of work and coming at it from different genres and different viewpoints, and trying to present both the diversity and the vital and exciting complexity of the border, but also this incredible bind that we're in together that both countries face. And really, I think what comes across is that it's the people themselves that face that conundrum while the governments actually have relatively little motive for trying to resolve the situation, because in reality, both the American government and the Mexican government benefit from
enormously
the current situation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're very motivated to leave it exactly like it is.
Right.
You know,
right.
To on the right, to stir enough people up, perhaps, to get people to the polls.
Right.
Your conservative base. But as far as legislation, it's much the same with abortion.
Right.
We're likely not to see actual legislation, but they're going to keep beating the drum because it gets people out to the polls. It gets people fired up. They call their local radio show.
Yeah, and it becomes very heated without reaching any sort of real conversation or real resolution. You know, it's akin to what you were saying just before I came on. You know, that there's a great deal of money to be made from offending people on both sides and getting people stirred up and launching campaigns that have to do with anger and with lack of understanding. But that's not what we're about. For us, VQR is one of those places where we try to engage in sane conversations and, you know, give people the space to be able to have civilized approaches to things and civilized conversations. And also, hopefully, that length requires that they do some serious thinking, that it's not just sound bites, but it's actual investigation and actual thorough discussion and thought. And when those ideas start playing off of each other, I think it gives the reader a lot to work with and the opportunity to form your own opinions and have informed opinions, no matter what they are.
We're talking with Ted Genoways, the editor-in-chief at the Virginia Quarterly Review. The spring issue is available now. You can check some of it out online at vqronline.org. There is an article in the new spring issue. I read every single word. It is a previously unpublished piece of work by Mark Twain, here seeing sunlight for the very first time, truly a lost document regarding Mark Twain writing about Walt Whitman. And
that's
it
right.
Is truly, me as a true Walt Whitman fan, this is really, really great reading. I mean, it's laugh out loud funny when you see what he was up to. So set the scene for us. We're in the 19th century in America. Walt Whitman, Mark Twain, arguably two of the greatest writers that America has yet seen, next to perhaps Washington Irving a few decades before. But Walt Whitman is incredibly controversial.
That's right. Yeah, it's first of all, it's hard for us to imagine now, but for all the years that Twain and Whitman overlapped as major writers in American letters, they had very limited contact with each other. So this document is exciting because it's got it's the longest record that we have of Twain writing about Whitman. But as you say, it's also incredibly funny, and it's a wonderful document because of what it represents historically. The setup is that Whitman had published it was his last major edition of Leaves of Grass in 1881 with James R. Osgood in Boston, and at some point the Boston District Attorney Oliver Stevens got his hands on a copy of Leaves of Grass and found that several passages were, in his estimation, obscene. And he decided that this book should therefore be taken off the market until those passages could be removed. This caught Twain's attention because Twain had always, of course, been working on sort of the edges of what was acceptable at the time also. And Osgood was also his publisher. And so the idea that one of his fellow authors was being attacked for something that he himself thought he might be vulnerable to seems to have caught Twain's eye, and he decided to come to Whitman's defense. The thing that is incredibly humorous is that what Twain decided to do was to write a mock editorial, as if it were written to the editor of the Boston Post. And the idea was that he was going to quote passages from well-known texts that everyone would have on their bookshelves and show that those passages were far more obscene than anything in Whitman. the joke of it was that in each case in the manuscript, just as he comes to the point where it's about to get really profane, he's made it appear as if the editor of the Post has inserted himself to say, no, 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 we simply cannot in a family newspaper publish work like this. And the point, of course, is that Twain's trying to show that all of these books that all of us already have on our bookshelves and all of us think are perfectly acceptable.
Great works of classical literature.
Right.
Are full of profanity and obscene scenes.
And could not be quoted in the newspaper. And indeed, the thing that I think is amusing about it is that not much has changed. I mean, many of those passages, I think, would be impossible to quote on the airwaves.
We can't read most of them here, but you can read them in the spring edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review. You could probably check out some of them online as well. VQROnline.org. Excerpts from classical literature deemed too obscene for Mark Twain, for anybody.
Exactly.
And yet there they are in the great works of Western civilization. Ted Genoways is the editor-in-chief at the VQR. The summer issue is, you're working on that now. Can you give us a little teaser when that will be available and what you're working on?
Yeah, it'll be out by July 1st. So it's still a ways off as far as the bookstores go. But the key thing is that we're putting together a group of photographers who have been working in Iraq, showing their photographs and getting text from them talking about what it is that they had to do in order to take those pictures, and in a couple of the cases, why they intend not to go back after their most recent trips. The thing that will stick with me always is talking to Ashley Gilbertson on the phone recently, and he said that he decided he couldn't go back to Iraq once he realized that he was not photographing anymore, hoping to show people what was happening and make things better, but he was there simply documenting the beginning of a decline. And to hear that from people who have been there on the ground and spent years of their lives photographing the carnage there, to hear them say that things are measurably worse and different now, I think it's just a message that people need to be hearing.
Yeah, it's incredibly disconcerting, and yet that's a message we keep getting from more and more people.
Right.
Even now among great Republican leaders in our country, which is really like, what are you saying?
Right. Yeah. And as I say, these people, the ones who have been there, you know, many of these photographers have been there more time than even the soldiers themselves, because, you know, Gilbertson is a great example. He started photographing over there in 2002 and has been there for months and months out of each year ever since.
Coming up in the summer issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review, the spring issue is in bookstores now. Ted, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. If you'd like a free copy of the spring edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review, we'll give it to the first caller at 977-1070 right now.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.